thank you for claiming your seat and letting us begin our next session. Actually, our next presentation, which is entitled Immigration Under the National Origins Quota System 1924 to 1965. Tori Hester is an assistant professor in the Department of History at St. Louis University. Her PhD is from the University of Oregon, and she currently serves on the executive board of the Immigration and Ethnic History Society. She has volunteered in the legal services of Refugee and Immigration Services. Her current book project, Between Protection and Punishment, under contract with the University of Chicago Press, examines the national and international origins of U.S. deportation policy between 1975 and 1924. Thank you very much for being with us today, Dr. Hester.
Hi. All right. Just a quick word. I'm a little bit nervous, but if I'm a little bit ragged for the first 2 minutes, I'll work out my nerves. Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay, so my talk today is going to have two bookends, between 1924 and 1965. So it's this period, which is low immigration. So at the beginning of the period I look at, there's roughly 13-14% of all people on U.S. soil are foreign-born. By the end, just under 6% are foreign-born. So I'm going to look at those years. So those are, and the bookends are major pieces of legislation. The legislation that starts this is passed really in 1924, and it invents an immigration system known as the National Origins System. Right. So, how many of you have heard of the National Origins System? Okay, so many of you. Okay, so the National Origins System is going to run until 1965. And at the beginning, the National Origins System really is designed, I'll tell you why, but for my intro I have here, is designed to cut down immigration in large part from Europe. Those immigrants that Dorothy was talking about the last talk, and the sentiment captured in things like this quote, this is about Italian immigrants. So of the 40,000 Italian immigrants who have landed at Castle Garden since the 1st of January, probably not one out of 10 was a desirable addition to the population of the country. At the same time, there's lots of other anti-immigrant sentiment. And Dorothy was talking about some of these, but this also captures this anti-immigrant sentiment that's building in the late 19th century is going to crest in 1924. So do you see the anti-immigrant image here? So the alligators are this idea that Catholics are some kind of an invading horde. Okay, so in 1924, this is a broad-based assumption by many native-born Americans. And then what will happen now is that's not how we think about this wave of immigration, right? We think about the contributions that these immigrants made to the U.S. and some of the contributions that made the U.S., right, such an incredibly wealthy country in the history of the world. And so what I'm going to take you through is what that law looked like, how it operated, and then why, for example, in 1965 it was taken down. Before we get going, how many of you visited Ellis Island in your lifetimes? Okay, right. And then, if I could have some more participation. How many of you remember from relatives or stories that you heard from other people of how hard it was for many immigrants facing anti-immigrant sentiment in the early 19th century? Do you have any like great stories? Yeah. Anti-German sentiment? Yeah. Who else? Can I have two more volunteers, please? Yeah.
My father came in 1913, and he was 15 years old, and he
So he had it tough, too. Okay, one more volunteer of a hard story. Okay, I'll leave it there. If I had students, I would say, if you were my students, I would say, I can be very patient and wait for another volunteer. So I'll pull that strategy in a little while. Okay, so today my talk is going to examine, as I said, three things. The creation of the National Origin System, what that law looked like. And then when it's operating, race really becomes, and ideas about race are really important during these years, and I'm going to examine that. And then I'm going to wrap up explaining why and how things changed, and so that the National Origin System was taken down in 65, what replaced it, and why by 65 people are celebrating this immigrant group that was so reviled in the 1920s. One of the themes, or themes I'm going to track through this talk, is that within immigration policy, especially during these years, there are tensions. There are tensions between labor policy and labor needs and anti-immigrant sentiment. And there's also tension between immigration policy and American foreign policy. And so we'll kind of see that at different points throughout the talk. Okay, so back to 1924. So in 1924, for the purposes of this talk, there is a major piece of immigration legislation. Before 1924, there's essentially qualitative restrictions, so that there's qualities of immigrants, and if you come to the U.S. with that quality, you are excluded. You're not supposed to immigrate. And so one of those categories is, like, if you're an idiot, you're not wanted. If you're a prostitute. These are qualitative exclusions. But there are also racial qualitative exclusions that we've talked about, and I know many of you already know of them. So, for example, Chinese workers are a racially excluded class. But in 1924, and one of the things that's so striking about the National Origin System is it introduces numerical restrictions or quantitative restrictions. So today, in 2014, we operate on an immigration system that is both qualitative and quantitative. That quantitative piece was innovated in the 1920s. Okay, so three parts of the immigration law that's relevant for my talk today, and that is, one, the system that's designed is organized to restrict the immigration, especially out of Southern and Eastern Europe. And how they manage to do that, and you can't see this, but I'll tell you what matters, is they rig up a system where different countries receive a certain amount of visas. So your national origin determines if you can get a visa. So on this national origin system, designed to encourage some kinds of immigration and restrict others. And the ones that are hit hardest with these national origin quotas are Italy is hit hard, and Eastern Europe. Now, the people in the U.S. who is fighting for this system, they're resting these ideas on a lot of different influences. And some of them are resting these national origins quotas and why they think that creating a system that racially or ethnically ranks Europeans, that assume that some Europeans, like people from the UK, will make better Americans than, like, Italian Americans. Some of those ideas behind the ranking are linked to eugenics. All right. So these are the same kinds of kind of reprehensible science and scientists that really is going to inform the Nazis. Other people behind the 1924 hierarchical ranking are prohibitionists. They don't like how much, like, the Italians drink. Other people fighting for these hierarchical rankings are informed by kind of ideas of social Darwinism and anti-Catholicism. the KKK at this time as a supporter of these restrictions. The KKK, as you'll probably know, is not just an organization that terrorizes African Americans, but also they're anti-Jewish and anti-Catholic. So this is the coalition that is behind, that pushes Congress to act. And so in 1924, they create this system. And so have I been clear on, like, the national origin system for people from the Eastern Hemisphere, at least in Europe? They've got these visa slots that are based on, like, some kind of equation that ranks people and how they'll assimilate into U.S. society. Is that clear enough? Okay. It's complicated stuff, and so I'm struggling always to make it as clear as I can. Okay, so that's one part of the 1924 law. Under it, Great Britain, as I said, had 66,000 slots, and Greece had 310. Every European nation received a quota of at least 100. 70% of all quota spaces, which is the equivalent of 110,000, went to Germany, Ireland, and England. So again, these provisions assume that not all Europeans are equal and that some make better Americans than others. And it writes this into immigration law. And these are going to be on the books until 1965. Now, lawmakers intended these limits, to limit European migration. But at the same moment, migration from Europe is starting to plummet, and it's going to remain low because of the Great Depression, World War II, and then the Cold War. And so all of these dynamics, legal and geopolitical, are going to lead to decades of very low emigration out of Europe. Okay, now the second part of the law that I'll talk about today has to do with visas and how Western politicians want what's going on out West to fit in this new system. Okay, so we're restrictionists lobbying for this visa system that we've just talked about. We're concerned a lot with limiting immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe. Some Western congressmen focused on Japanese immigration. Okay, so by 1924, there's Chinese exclusion on the books, and that says Chinese workers cannot lawfully immigrate to the U.S. And in 1917, there's another law, big immigration law, and one of those provisions creates this thing called the Asiatic Barred Zone. How many of you have heard of this? Okay, so a few of you, not many. So it's this system that said anybody in that green zone cannot lawfully immigrate to the U.S. So this is writing the anti-Asian racism into U.S. policy. Now, all of China is already excluded. The only part of Asia that's not already written into immigration law or these immigration restrictions is Japan. So in 1924, when Congress is talking about passing major immigration legislation, many Western politicians are saying, listen, Japanese people are still immigrating, even though they'd had tried other ways to stop immigration out of Japan, from Japan into the U.S. And so Congress writes in a way to exclude or close off lawful immigration from Japan, and this is how they do it. Hasia was talking earlier today about the racialized naturalization policy in the U.S. So by 1870, in order to naturalize, this is the law, kind of this is what the law says. It said, if you are white or of African heritage, you can lawfully naturalize to the U.S. And so what politicians do in this 1924 immigration law said is, okay, we're going to give 100 quota seats to Japan, but for anybody to get one of those visa slots, they have to be able to naturalize. So that means only white people can naturalize, and white people can get that visa slot. And so in 1924, that law closes off lawful immigration from all of Asia. And those racial exclusions are really going to be on the books for another few decades. Okay. Now, part of this, these anti-Asian exclusions is in many ways similar to what the like Italians or Eastern Europeans were experiencing, but it was also different because of the way race played out and what race means in this country. So, for example, Japanese immigrants to the U.S., there was a sentiment, especially by many white Westerners, that they were racial justifications to restrict immigration out from Asia. And there were assumptions that non-white people did not make as good Americans as white Americans. And this is going to affect the kids of, for example, Japanese immigrants. So Japanese immigrants have kids. Those kids are American. They grow up liking baseball like other American kids. Not all. Like, not everybody likes baseball, but sorry. But one of the things that is striking about the narratives of these kids of Japanese parents is that they often say, like, we felt American. But when we talk to many other Americans, many white Americans, they assumed something called racial naturalization. This is a concept that, like, we're all familiar with, but it's just, like, an academic label to it. And so many, like, American kids of Japanese immigrant parents were legally American, they felt American. But when many white Americans, like in the 1930s or the 1940s, saw them, they saw their Japanese heritage and assumed that they were not American. So that's kind of racial naturalization. And it works the other way. So, for example, if you're a white Canadian and you immigrate to the U.S., your white skin often, people assume you're American. So that's, this term is clear enough, racial naturalization? Okay. And this is going to culminate and be a major factor, for example, in Japanese internment during World War II. Okay, so the third important point about the national origin system is that it did not apply to the Western Hemisphere. So these numerical restrictions apply to people in the Eastern Hemisphere. So under this system, as many Canadians or as many Mexicans who wanted to immigrate could, so long as they met two qualifications. One is that they weren't one of the excludable categories. So if you were a Canadian prostitute, you weren't supposed to immigrate to the U.S. And the second thing is, in the 1920s, there was the introduction of a new document requirement, so that if you wanted to come to the U.S., you're supposed to pay visa fees, head taxes. And so if you didn't do that, you didn't have the right documents to be here. Okay. But so in 1924, the decision by lawmakers not to include the Western Hemisphere was driven in large part by labor demands. And that is, especially out west, this is a time when Western agribusiness is booming. So around 1900, farms out in California, they're not very big, they're not very profitable. But by the 1920s, agribusiness out west in places like California and Texas, they're producing 40% of all agricultural goods in the United States. They're powerful. And their productivity depends on having low-wage workers, and they are increasingly looking to Mexicans. And so here's a moment where, on one hand, there are many Americans who say we should have restriction on Canadians and Mexicans. But then within policy, policymakers supported by agribusiness are saying we have to have workers. Don't include Mexicans or Canadians in this system. So they're not. So I'm going to take a moment here and just follow the kind of a case study of Mexican immigration over the next, 30 years after 1924. Okay, so in the 1920s, Mexicans immigrate to the U.S. in unprecedented numbers. They're leaving Mexico because of economic crisis. political turmoil, social unrest, and they're immigrating to the U.S. because there's good jobs up here. Now, after 24, many are coming. Many don't pay the visa fees. Many don't get the right documents, and they come to the U.S. anyways. But many do, and many of those immigrants then have kids and become, you know, have strong, vibrant Mexican American communities in places like Los Angeles. Now, in the 1930s, that idea of racial naturalization really comes into play. And so, what happened? How many of you have heard of Mexican repatriation? Okay, so in the 1930s, when Americans are struggling because of the Great Depression, there are, especially out in places like Los Angeles, many white Americans assume that both Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans, Americans born on U.S. soil, somehow are less entitled to jobs. And somehow, even if you are born on U.S. soil, if you are somehow of Mexican heritage, that you should probably go to Mexico. And so some cities like L.A. actually round up Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans, and they repatriate them to Mexico. And so in the 1930s, you have actually a decline of the Mexican immigrant and Mexican American community, because many Mexicans are forcefully repatriated to Mexico, but also many Mexican immigrants actually voluntarily return to Mexico because there are no jobs here. So that's something called Mexican repatriation. And so one of the things that Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants is unique about their immigrant experience is that they're not racially excluded like Asian immigrants, but their experience is racialized, and it's racialized in some of the ways that African Americans find themselves racialized, like in places like California. This sign on your left, right, that looks pretty similar to Jim Crow in the U.S. South. But also Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, also one of the things that makes their racialized a little different is the deportability, either of themselves or their family members. Okay, so 1930s is a low period in immigration to the U.S. from anywhere. But then in World War II, things change. And one of the things that happens in World War II is there is a huge demand in agribusiness for low-wage workers, because Americans who were working in working in the fields, they move into high-paying wartime jobs, manufacturing jobs, or they go to war. And so many agribusiness leaders convince Congress and immigration authorities to create a massive guest worker program called the Bracero Program. This program is justified originally as, like, the agribusiness said, listen, there's lots of workers in Mexico who want to work. Let's create a legal guest worker program that will bring them in. They'll work for a term of the contract and then return. So this is really a new class of immigrant. And it's not a class of immigrant that all the immigrants that, like, from 1880 to 1924, that if an immigrant came during those years, oh, wait, am I talking too fast? But I can talk louder? Oh, I'm good, okay. So between 1880 or 1924, the period that Hasi was talking about, if you came to the U.S., you could bring your family, you could settle here. But the guest worker is a different legal category. And your legal residence is tied to your employment. And if you don't like that job, or you don't want to leave, like, or if you're being mistreated, then you have to leave the country. And also a lot of time, the discipline to your employer, your legal status is dependent upon this. So especially in this big program that's starts in 1943, it lasts until 1964, and over 4.5 million people from Mexico sign these Bracero contracts to come and work in the United States. I'm a historian, and I love the history of law and policy, as you can probably imagine. And people also love social history, what life was like. So to do that, I'm going to show you some pictures. So this is a bunch of guys. Now, the Bracero program was a program only open to men. And so Mexico was a part of this program, and they didn't want their skilled labor force leaving Mexico to go get ag jobs in the U.S., because agricultural jobs in many cases paid higher than Mexican white-collar labor. So part of the term of the Bracero program, which is a guest worker program negotiated by Mexico and the U.S., is that you have to go to these processing centers if you want to sign a contract. And these are guys coming to go to that processing center. And then there's inspections. And one of the things that happens is if you were one of these guys, you had to show your hands. And I would fail because my hands don't look like an agricultural worker. So they were looking for evidence that you were not a white-collar worker. Here they're answering questions, signing contracts, also sprayed with DDT. The Braceros would be brought to the U.S. U.S. employers would select people. Let's see. Can I go back? Okay. I can't go back. I won't make that point. Okay. So guest workers during these years. So the Bracero program ran from 43 to 64. And during these years, there's other kinds of guest worker programs. So guest worker programs were not exclusively Mexican, but they were predominantly Mexican. So, for example, between 1952 and 1961, American employers asked for about 3.5 million guest workers. Canadians, where I was born, made up about 60,000 of those guest workers. They were the third largest group imported for guest work in agriculture. The second largest group came largely from Jamaica. Over 3.4 million of 3.5, about 95% are coming from Mexico. Okay. So these guest worker programs reflected an attempt to balance the tension in immigration policy for labor and dealing with the difficulties of immigrating lawfully. And these programs were intended to use immigration policy to supply workers to U.S. employers. Okay, so that's the first half of my talk. Now I'm going to switch, and I'm going to talk about the declining support for the national origins system and when and why those racial bars that discriminate against Asians and also discriminate against certain ethnicities coming out of Europe. World War II is a big turning point in support for the national origin system. And I'm going to give you about four reasons. And one of those is China. So in 1943, the U.S. ends Chinese exclusion. And Chinese are given 105 visa slots to immigrate lawfully. Okay, so why 1943? Tell me why 1943 is when American government has to take Chinese exclusion off the books. Yeah, absolutely. They're our allies, right? So it's you can't have a law that's so discriminatory on the books with your allies. So that happens. Okay, so another reason is so coming out of World War II, there is an awareness of the costs of racial naturalization and these racial exclusions. And one of those is, let's see, I think I have them next. Oh, that's more Braceros working. Oh, these are, again, that's some more social history. These are the bunks the Braceros lived in. How many of you have you ever seen this photo? Has any? Okay, so this is a pretty famous picture of a brasero. I've got my slides out of order. Okay, so this is Japanese internment, where the camps are located through the country. And coming out of 1945, there is an growing sentiment that this was a terrible decision, and it was racially motivated. So in the U.S., in Japanese internment, about two-thirds of the Japanese-American community is interned. One-third is not, and so the entire Japanese-American community in Hawaii, they're not interned. It's only the continental Japanese-American community. And so Americans really begin to see the way that race is working in policy. And that's a problem. And not only does this have issues of race, but it has issues of the meaning of U.S. citizenship. And so two-thirds of all the people interned in Japanese internment are U.S. citizens. And so there's a growing sense that, you know, you can't treat people like that on the basis of race. Okay, another thing that is turning the tide against these Asian restrictions is also the contributions of Asian Americans during World War II. Do I have any World War II buffs? Okay. There's a celebration coming out of World War II of Japanese-American contributions to the war effort. And so can someone, like, explain, especially the famous unit? Is it 442? 442. So for everybody who's not, a 442 buff, why are they celebrated? Why are they so popularly known? Yeah. Yeah, so this is the most decorated unit in military history. Do I have that right? Okay. Highest decorated in World War II. Better. Thank you. Okay. So increasingly, Japanese Americans are seen through a different lens, and race, in some ways. That's me being nervous. Okay, so after the war, there's another thing that is going to factor into why Americans pull down the national origin system, and that's the Holocaust. So immigration laws like 1924 had these incredibly strong restrictions, and countries around the world, not just the U.S., built these. Canada, Australia, countries throughout South America had these policies that were designed to keep out Jews. And when Jews are trying to flee the Nazis in 33, it is hard for many Jews to get into somewhere else, to find refuge. And so after 45, there is a global commitment to humanitarian crises. And so you see the creation at the UN of the UN High Commission on Refugees. And so in the US, coming out of World War II, US policymakers create for the first time formal refugee policy. And that refugee policy is framed within the global commitment through things like the UNHCR, but also ad hoc legislation designed to help people. The first major program is the displaced person. How many of you have known people who are DPs or have family members? Okay, so some of you all. Also, refugee policy in the U.S. since 1947 through 1980. Is tied to Cold War foreign policy objectives. So U.S. refugee policy is incredibly humanitarian, but it is linked to Cold War foreign policy, and that is people fleeing left-wing dictatorships can get asylee status or refugee status, but people fleeing right-wing dictatorships propped up by the Americans until the mid-1980s find it almost impossible to get legal status in this country. How am I doing on time? Do I have like 5 minutes left? Okay. Okay, so U.S. Cold Foreign Policy, here is a picture of the DPs. DP policy, displaced person policy, really responded to both the people displaced by World War II, but then also the expansion of the communist bloc. And this is a DP camp, and many people are resettled within the U.S. from these camps. When I teach refugee policy, my students are especially interested in the refugee flows out of Cuba, and they love hearing about Operation Pedro Pan. Operation Pedro Pan? Okay, so Castro comes to power in Cuba in 59. That's the first wave of Cuban refugees fleeing Castro and coming to the United States. Between 1960 and 1962, about 14,000 kids, their parents in Cuba, send them to the U.S. to get them out of Cuba. And so it's called Operation Pedro Pan. Anyway, so that's a picture. In the 1952, there's this growing sentiment that big pieces of the national origin system are a real problem. And in 1952, there's a law that does a couple of things. And one is they take down the most explicit racial provisions. So they take down the exclusions. Anti-Asian exclusions. So after 1952, people from Japan, from India, can lawfully immigrate. But 1952, there's still a lot of Americans who said those ethnic rankings of European are important. And so there's not enough support to tear down the national origins quota distribution. One of the things that, so I teach at St. Louis University, which is a Jesuit school, and so when I teach this and I talk about when Kennedy is running for president, there's a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment that is trying to stop his presidential bid. And I'll give you a quote here. So as Kennedy starts running for president, a new wave of religiously based opposition to Kennedy emerges, and a collection of 150 Protestant clergymen formed a group called Citizens for Religious Freedom to stop his presidential bid. And members included Billy Graham's father-in-law, Nelson Bell. And one of the members of this group said, "Our American culture is at stake. I don't say it won't survive, but it won't be what it was." And so this is kind of a quote that captures there's still a lot of support for these ethnically discriminatory quotas. But between 52 and 65, you have the expansion of the civil rights movement. Many groups like the Italian American community, Jewish American communities, the Greek American community, they're lobbying in ever increasingly effective ways for comprehensive immigration law reform. They didn't use that term, but they were asking for it. And so in 1965, it all comes to a head, and Congress rewrites the immigration system. And they finally take out the national origins quota system. And so what they do then is they replace it with a system the new immigration system that Congress replaces the national origin system with in 1965 was composed of a series of family-based preferences, hemispheric quotas, and country caps. These legislative changes expanded the number of visas for skilled workers, but curtailed the numbers of guest workers, seats open to agricultural laborers. And the new system also explicitly and drastically reduced the number of visas issued to low-wage workers from Mexico. And so I'm going to end on one more sentence. So I've just said, like, this is what the new system does, and I'm giving you a sense that something's about to, like, go completely wrong in all new ways. And that is your last speaker's like part of his job. So if you have like really tough questions, they're for him. Okay.
Questions?
Oh. I probably mumbled through that. They're just really brave and hardworking, and so they're exceptional soldiers.
Their mission was to rescue some, I think it was in southern France.
And in Italy?
Italy?
Yeah.
And rescue some, another American unit that had been trapped, and they experienced several injuries, Purple Hearts kind of added up in the total, Bronze Stars, things like that. But it was mainly their heroism.
Yeah, so really gripping military history. Yeah. You're right.
In 1946, British General Lieutenant William Hunt Bowen came to Manila and Singapore. 1946, I think it was in May. And at the airport, honor guard of 2,000 soldiers presented arms and the samurai swords dressed in Japanese uniforms. Because the British didn't have enough garrison to control the communists in the jungle, so they put the Japanese in the prisoner camps for them to fight against the communists. So, just a trivia.
Yeah, when I teach the deep history of Vietnam, that's also another interesting piece, which again gets, it's going to maybe foreshadow the, and I don't know if Michael will talk about it, but the refugee flow increasingly. So when Dorothy was talking about, and Hasia, lots of immigration is attracted to the United States because of the economic power of the United States. But increasingly during the Cold War, immigration becomes tied to foreign policy, and especially refugee policy. So after 47, wherever there is a major American intervention in terms of foreign policy, it is going to be immediately followed by a refugee flow, whether it's formally recognized or not. So one of when students get into this, one of the thing is that this national origin system happens just when immigration out of Europe is declining. And so there's not as many people trying to get into the United States from those communities. And so there's not the ethnic succession that really helps define and create vibrant ethnic communities. So it's not so much about like racial assimilation. But it is about kind of change over time. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So the act corresponded with some natural decline in immigration.
Yeah, and so.
To changes in that community.
Yeah, so when you talk to other immigration historians, so some people will say 1924 did everything. And then you'll talk to other historians and they'll say, well, in 1929, whether you have this immigration law or not, no one's coming to the U.S. because there are no jobs. So there's a way to which some people under, like for me as a teacher, it's handy to say 1924 and then you see a drop in immigration, but there's larger geopolitical reasons. Like, so during the Cold War, there's lots of people who would like to come to the U.S., but they can't get out of the Eastern Bloc. So yeah, Dorothea.